The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sports Illustrated for Kids. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the January-February issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to start on the front cover. It has a picture here of Detroit's own Dylan Larkin. Has Hockey Town believing anything is possible? Well, hometown heroes and a few villains. Hometown heroes, page 34. There's no place like home to be a dominant athlete. Here are some stars who have become local legends and a few villains as well. Motor City Mojo. Dylan Larkin grew up near Detroit, played in college at Michigan, and is now captain of the Red Wings. What we can look forward to in this issue? Well, faves, feed frame, sports cards, hot take, birthdays, posters, the treehouse, what's the call, games, art gallery, Buzz Beamer. Now that Negro Leagues are officially recognized by Major League Baseball, here are some of the faces behind the numbers. Page 18. What if money were no object in sports? We'd have Brent barnstorming hoopsters and a lot more highlight on TV. Page 22. Forget burning questions. We've got the answer to some wintry inquiries ahead of the Beijing Winter Olympics. Scott Henderson dominated high school, got his diploma a year early, and is now wowing the pros in the G League. We're going to begin on page 8, Who's Who in Sports. We have Bam Adebayo, center for the Miami Heat. His height is 6'9", his weight is 255 pounds. He was born July 18, 1997, hometown Pinetown, North Carolina. After 18 games, Abadio was averaging 18.7 points and 10.2 rebounds per contest, both of which equaled his career highs. Last summer, Abadio won a gold medal with Team USA at the Tokyo Olympics, leading the squad with 5.7 rebounds per game. But did you know he was born Edris Femi Abadio, but his mom nicknamed him Bam Bam after the Flintstones character Bam Bam when he flipped over a table as a child? Michaela Callahan, BYU Cougars forward. Her height is 5'8". She was born February 25th, 1999, in her hometown, Kaysville, Utah. As a senior, Callahan led BYU to the NCAA championship game, where the Cougars fell to Florida State on penalty kicks. Callahan was second in the country with 18 goals, and her 15 assists were fourth best. She was drafted by the Orlando Pride in January 2021, but elected to return to school for a shot at a national championship. Did you know North Carolina won the NCAA Women's Soccer Tournament 16 of the first 19 years it was held? Edouard Mendy, Chelsea goalkeeper. His height is 6'4", his weight is 205 pounds. He was born March 1, 1992, in his hometown, Montvillers, France. In his first season with Chelsea, Mendy kept 9 clean sheets in Champions League play as the Blues won the competition. Through his first 15 games of 2021-22 domestic season, he had 7 clean sheets and led the Premier League with an 85.1% save percentage. Mendy was named 2021 UEFA Goalkeeper of the Year. But did you know Chelsea beat Manchester's City 1-0 in the Champions League final? It was the third time since 2008 that two English teams met for the championship. February birthdays. February 4th, Edmonton Oilers defenseman Darnell Nurse turns 27 years old. February 7th, Los Angeles Rams quarterback Matthew Stafford is 34 years old. February 15th, Clayton Knights winger, NHL legend Jaromir Jagr is still going at 50. February 22nd, Phoenix Mercury point guard Kaya Nurse is 26. And finally, February 23rd, Golden State Warriors forward Andrew Wiggins turns 27. Ready to roll. At Garrett's suggestion, the D&D group dubbed itself the Heathers, and they met regularly at the Tackle's house. Sorcery, just call him Alucard. Ferocious on the field, Miles Garrett is scary on the Dungeons and Dragons staple, too. Miles Garrett was on a mission. Soon after he reported to Brown's training camp in late July, the edge rusher displaying a level of urgency ordinarily reserved for the pursuit of Dune quarterbacks tracked down teammate Johnny Stanton with a burning question. Hey, so when are we going to start up again? Garrett was referring to Dungeons and Dragons. Stanton is a reserve fullback who doubles as a Dungeon Dragon master, serving up a fantasy saga of puzzles to solve, people to save, and bloodthirsty baddies to slay. The regular game he oversees includes Garrett, All-Pro Browns guard Wyatt Teller, and several friends. The group first came together in September 2020 at Stanton's behest. As the only one with any prior D&D experience, the Dragon Master began by helping everyone choose characters. Prioritizing stealth over strength, Garrett built a half-elf rogue assassin named Garrett the Grey, a nod to both Gandalf and Will the Wise. Teller, too, was inspired by J.R.R. Tolkien in creating Flapper, a lumbering half-arc berserker barbarian with meaty hands and a habit of flying into rages during battle. This year, Garrett decided he wanted a new character. So Garrett the Grey nobly sacrificed himself to save the rest of the gang, who then picked up Garrett's new character, Alucard, a half-vampire. Garrett had no experience with D&D, but in 2020, Stanton saw him wearing a Stranger Things t-shirt at the Browns facility and summoned the courage to ask whether Garrett had ever considered playing like the kids on the show. I might be into trying it, Garrett replied. It since turned into a bonding experience unlike any across the NFL, even if the mere mention of the game triggers some chuckles in stodgier corners of the Browns locker room, says Teller. Moments you spend together are more important than guys being like, hey, what are you going doing, playing D&D? Well, it's fun. It's different, but it's a good time. What if money were no object? Money is running sports, or so they keep saying. Ever since Major League Baseball banned 8 members of the Chicago White Sox for allegedly taking bribes to throw the 1919 World Series, fans have worried about business tainting their beloved games. Those concerns have multiplied as leagues have become billion-dollar businesses. Money, money, money. Is it ruining sports? Asked the cover of a special 1978 issue of Sports Illustrated. Paying students to play would ruin college sports, read the headline of a 2019 op-ed in the New York Times. All that dough has done some good. Money allows hard-working athletes to rise from humble beginnings to lives of comfort and security. Teams and players regularly use their positions to raise funds for worthy causes. It is money that allows the production of magazines full of silly hypothetical articles, like this one. But while cash might not be ruining sports, it makes certain aspects annoying. NFL games have so many TV timeouts, the broadcasts feel like one long ad. Stars are regularly put in the position of abandoning a team they like to get the best deal for themselves. The best seats in every arena often go to business people, entertaining clients who aren't even fans. And boy, have microtransactions made video games tedious. As for the sake of better franchise modes in our games and better crowds in our stadiums, let's imagine a world without any money at all, in sports and otherwise. It may not be as impossible as it seems. There is an idea called the post-scarcity economy, a complicated sounding term for a potential future in which no one needs money because there's nothing they need to buy, usually thanks to a technological breakthrough. This idea is in part the premise of the future in Star Trek. an invention called the replicator can basically 3D print anything a human might want, such as a turkey sandwich, T-shirt, or gold-plated fidget spinner. So humans spend less time making stuff and more time traveling through space. We're not interested in the galactic implications of a replicator-like invention, however. In a future which humans don't need to pass the time doing menial tasks, what happens to our favorite pastimes? Well, for starters, the very idea of professional sports would have to change. These days, going pro means crossing the threshold from unpaid amateur participation into the lucrative world of sponsorships and contracts. For many years, college stars went from unemployed to millionaires overnight. While NCAA players have recently started profiting off their own names, images, and likenesses, blurring the line of who counts as a pro, the line would simply cease to exist in the post-scarcity world. A professional athlete would be anyone who made a competitive activity their chosen vocation, whether that's an unknown marbles player or LeBron James, 44. The freedom to do what you want could mean a lot more people trying to make the big leagues and even more people tuning in. It could also mean a greater variety of games and activities get a chance to shine. The huge financial power of the biggest sports leagues create a sort of self-sacrificing prophecy. More people play football and baseball because those sports offer a chance to one day become rich and famous. More fans watch baseball and football because they played those games growing up. And all those people tuning in give those leagues the revenue necessary to market their sport to even more new fans. Are football, baseball, basketball, hockey, and soccer the five best sports in the world? Or are they just the lucky ones who got in early and used their profits to fortify their position? Can you say for certain that high-lie isn't the greatest sport ever invented? I know I can't. And when everyone can just print out traditionally expensive equipment, the barrier to entry for unusual sports will never be lower. The game experience can only improve in a cash-free world. Without high ticket prices, there will be more packed houses. And while you may not pay attention to what your parents pay, concession prices are ridiculous. When the whole menu is free, you will have a better argument for getting an ice cream helmet. No more naming rights deals would allow for more iconic stadium facades like Wrigley Fields. The biggest changes, however, would be in store for the people who profit the most from the current system. No longer will players be said to underperform or overperform relative to their salaries. And without a billionaire needed to cut their paychecks, the entire idea of an owner going out the window. Really, the modern concept of a league wouldn't be needed, either as it mostly serves to consolidate the power and resources of the owners. When the only motivation for playing is seeking out the best competition, the top clubs can return to barnstorming, the practice of traveling far and wide to seek the best competition. Imagine a band of carefree fans following an NBA All-Star team around the world, expense-free as it takes on all challengers. Sound fun? Well, one of you will have to invent that replicator first. Pay attention in science class for all our sakes. Hometown heroes, don't stop believing. Detroit's Dylan Larkin wants to bring Hockey Town back to glory. The first time Red Wings captain Dylan Larkin played in Detroit's NHL arena, he forgot his jersey. The mistake didn't make national news. He was, after all, only 10 years old and a member of the Lakeland Hawks who were playing the Kensington Valley Rebels in the state finals. They ended up beating us, Larkin says. I had to wear someone else's jersey, and I was so nervous I don't think I played that well. But it was such a cool experience. I'll never forget how good the ice was. Larkin, 25, grew up in Waterford Township, Michigan, a 45-minute drive from the Wings, then home, Joe Louis Arena. That's why Detroit's previous two Stanley Cup wins in 2002 and 2008 are not just lofty standard for Larkin, but sources of fond memories. He recalls wearing your jersey to school day and getting nights off from homework when the Wings were in the finals. In an era in which athletes rarely come up playing for the team they loved as kids, Larkin has managed to do something even more impressive. Spending his entire career in Southeast Michigan, he won a Pee Wee State title in Detroit. He played for the United States National Development Team program, then based in nearby Ann Arbor as a teenager. He stayed in Ann Arbor after graduating from the program to play for the University of Michigan. And after a season for the Wolverines, he surprised many by making the Red Wings at just 19. He traveled all over the world as a member of Team USA. But the farthest from home he's ever been based was Grand Rapids, Michigan, where he played 6 playoff games for the Wings, AHL affiliate, after being drafted. Now, as if by fate, he's back home in Detroit, hoping to get some local kids out of doing their homework very soon. Lucky numbers. Larkin impressed his coaches every step of the way with his speed and leadership ability. Leading up to the 2014 NHL draft, experts projected the Michigan commit to go somewhere in the second half of the first round, around pick 20. The Red Wings had the 15th selection. Sitting in the crowd at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia, Larkin turned to his parents as Detroit was on the clock and asked them, "Wouldn't this be so cool?" Sure enough, when Red Wings GM Ken Holland started to announce it, "I had a great feeling," Larkin says. "It's one of those moments that's a blur. You're so excited. Time went by so fast. When I talk to kids that are going to the draft, I tell them, enjoy it and soak it all in. Take a second look to look around." I didn't do that. I just buried my head and tried not to trip going up the stairs. One of Larkin's biggest challenges adjusting to the Red Wings was picking a number. One of the NHL's oldest and most successful franchises, Detroit has retired 8 numbers, with a few more unofficially retired and no longer issued. Larkin's first number growing up was 99, retired throughout hockey in honor of Wayne Gretzky. Then he wore 19 as his older brother, Colin, idolized Canucks center Marcus Naslund, and Dylan idolized Colin. The number 19 is retired by Detroit for its former captain and Larkin's current boss, Steve Yzerman. Its inverse 91 belonged to Yzerman's legendary teammate, Sergei Fedorov. He lost his second and third choices, 25 and 17, to veterans. So Larkin wears 71, a number significant for its significance in Red Wings lore. No one wore it for more than a season before Larkin. All that incredible franchise history was not so far in the past for Larkin. His favorite Red Wing going up was Heinrich Zetterberg, who had led the team to that 2008 Cup. In his rookie season, Larkin often played on the Wings' top line with his idol. He finished the year with 23 goals and had 22 assists and potted his first playoff goal against the Lightning. I don't think I can really put it into words, the transition from being a fan and idolizing him to playing with him and becoming friends with him and ultimately learning from him, Larkin says. That playoff appearance was the 25th in a row for Detroit, a streak that started in 1990-91, 5 years before Larkin was born. The Wings haven't made the postseason since. Larkin's time with Zetterberg was a special one. It was also a transition. In 2018-2019, after Zetterberg's retirement, Larkin had his best season yet, registering 32 goals and 41 assists in 76 games. The team, however, finished just 32-40-10. Now, a city used to winning is counting on its native son to deliver them back to glory. Veteran presence. In January 2021, the Red Wings announced that Larkin would be the team's 37th captain, its first since Zetterberg. The honor reflects that he's the team's best player and a leader in the community. Larkin has volunteered his time at the Special Olympics in Waterford and teamed up with his dad, who works in the beauty industry, to donate extra gloves and masks to local hospitals during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now he's living up to the responsibility of the captaincy on the ice. Before the NHL paused its season before the holidays, Larkin led the resurgent Red Wings with 29 points, 15 goals, and 14 assists in 27 games. Detroit was 15-13-3 at the break, on pace for its first winning season since 2015-2016. And Larkin, who got to live his dream a few short years ago by playing with his idols, already finds himself in the opposite position, leading a pair of star rookies in Swedish winger Lucas Raymond and German defenseman Moritz Seider. The Wings' success also owes to a hometown reunion. They traded in the offseason for starting goalie Alex Nedeljkovic, an old friend of Larkin from his under-16 team. Now a fairy tale career seems destined for a storybook ending. But for Larkin, the idea of the hometown hero ending the title drought is almost beyond comprehension. It's something I've thought about, and I don't even know how much excitement I would have, Larkin says. I don't even know what I would do with the cup. I think I would probably just bring it to the center of Waterford and have everyone spend some time with it. Forget burning questions. How about these 20 freezing questions related to the upcoming Beijing Olympics? Wintry inquiries. Ski jumping. How high off the ground is that guy? Ski jumpers glide down a 400-foot hill, hitting speeds up to 60 miles per hour. Then they launch themselves into the air, soaring farther than the length of a football field before touching down. It's a majestic sight to behold, as a human defies gravity and flies through the air at the impressive altitude of about 15 feet. Yeah, if you look closely, you'll see that the end of the takeoff hill isn't shaped like a ramp. It's straight, so skiers get airborne in a relatively straight line. Then they follow the arc of the landing hill, never more than 10 or 15 feet off the ground. That's not to say the sport isn't thrilling or dangerous, but the illusion of flight is largely just that, an illusion. Skeleton. How do you slow down? Well, you don't. And skeleton competitors lie down on the sled with their chins an inch or two off the surface of the ice. They steer by making subtle movements with their knees and shoulders as they reach speeds of more than 80 miles per hour. It's a harrowing ordeal, and if things start to go sideways, there's not much a rider can do. There are no brakes. And if there were, using them would eliminate any chance a rider had of winning a medal, because the margin of victory is usually a couple of hundredths of a second. Curling. What does sweeping do? Unlike ice hockey and figure skating, curling doesn't take place on a perfectly smooth surface. The surface is purposely covered with small pebbles of ice. When a stone is sliding down the rink, those pebbles create friction, which slows down the stone and makes it curl. Sweeping creates friction that melts those pebbles, so sweeping can make a stone go farther and curl less than it normally would, meaning that an imperfectly thrown rock can still end up exactly where it was intended. Speed skating. How fast are they going? Really fast. Okay, you want more of an answer than that? Long track speed skating, the version that Team USA's Brittany Bowe, pictured above, competes in, is a race against the clock. Those athletes can reach up to 35 miles per hour. Usain Bolt's top speed without ice skates was around 28 miles per hour. Either clip would get you pulled over in a school zone. Short track speed skating pits racers against each other in a tight course where collisions happen. That means slightly less speed, though not by much. They still top 30 miles per hour. Usually it takes just a tick over 13 miles per hour to win the fastest skater competition in the NHL All-Star Skills Competition. Bobsled. What are those other three guys who aren't steering do? In the four-man bobsled, the driver steers the sled. So what about the other people? Their job is to get the sled up to speed by pushing it at the start. There is no way for the driver to make the sled go faster. All he has at his disposal is gravity, as the sled picks up speed as it goes down the course. Once the sled is moving, the other three competitors need to stay low so they don't introduce drag, which will slow down the sled. They also have to remain still to maintain the balance of the sled and make it easier for the driver to control the line, which is crucial to a fast run. It's a fairly anonymous job, but someone has to do it. Alpine skiing. Is Michaela Schifrin her sports goat? The term goat gets tossed out so much these days, it's losing meaning. For some people, however, the greatest of all time, honorific, actually is within reach. Michaela Schifrin is only 26 years old and will be competing in just her third Olympics. But is she already the best ever? Maybe. And at her age, that's impressive enough. She has 3 Olympic medals, 2 gold and 1 silver, and the women's record in alpine skiing is 6. Kjetil Andre Amundt of Norway leads all alpine skiers with 8. Schifrin has a chance to tie Amundt in Beijing as she plans to compete in all 5 individual events. Schifrin's 71 World Cup wins Trelawny Lindsey Vonn and Ingemar Stenmark, both of whom are retired. Vonn said Schifrin is in a league of her own right now, and Stenmark thinks he will blow his record out of the water. Pretty good endorsements. With the top pros stuck at home, who's playing? It's easy to mention who's not going. For many of the Canadian players who won gold in Vancouver in 2010 and Sochi in 2014, these Olympics were supposed to be a swan song. Sidney Crosby is no lock to make an Olympic roster when he's 38 in 2026. Team USA's Auston Matthews on the right may end up being the greatest hockey player ever to come out of the United States. But now he won't make his Olympic debut until he's 28, at the earliest. Expect teams to stock their rosters with whomever they can find on short notice. Allers, college kids, and guys playing abroad. How do you have a luge relay race? Passing a baton from hand to hand in a foot race is hard. So how is it done when the racers are going feet first on a sled down a track at speeds almost 90 miles an hour? Allow us to introduce the giant bullseye. In the luge relay, a female competitor makes a run down the course. At the finish, she hits a touch pad that opens the starting gate for a male competitor. He makes his run and then hits the bullseye, which allows the doubles two-man team to start. When they hit the touchpad, the clock stops, and the team had its total time. It's hectic? Yes. Is it one of the coolest events in the games? Absolutely. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sports Illustrated for Kids is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.